What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a whole lot of modern America wrapped up in the mall, riding on the mall. Time was they were the future. One day they started to feel old. New ones cropped up to cannibalize old ones or blow off the middle class and serve the rich. It matters to many communities whether they thrive or change or die. All three are happening right now. This hour On Point, the state of malls in America and what it tells us. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you so over the mall? Still going? Is your local mall thriving or dying or becoming something else? And what does that mean to your community? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a little excerpt from the 1950s, a PR short called Shopping Can Be Fun, Selling Americans on the Modern Wonder, the Suburban Mall.
These young adults shopping with the same determination that led them to the suburbs in the first place are the goingest part of a nation on wheels.
Oh boy, it's great. Here's more.
It's a happy-go-spending world, reflected in the windows of the suburban shopping centers where they go to buy.
And now, maybe not so much. Here's Linda Witten watching the demolition of the Palm Beach Mall with her five grandchildren here in an interview with the Palm Beach Post. She says the mall was a social center for her as a kid.
Just coming here shopping all the time. We shopped. We lived here. We had the movie theater was here. This was our hangout.
Here it goes down, a countdown to take down the Palm Beach Mall, 2013.
Five, four, three, two, one.
And it is not the only mall that has bit the dust. Susan Kapner joins us right now from New York. She covers the retail industry for the Wall Street Journal. Suzanne, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we've got a news hook this week, and maybe it takes us into this story of malls. Simon is a huge mall owner, Simon Property Group, and they're looking to buy more. What's going on there, Suzanne?
Well, they are the largest mall owner, but there's no new shopping malls being built, so the only way they can grow really is to buy a competitor, number three, Macerich.
And why are they doing that if malls are in so much trouble?
Well, it's really not all malls that are in trouble. There are the best performing malls, they're so-called A malls, that have very high sales, are doing just fine. It's everybody else that's in trouble.
You've got A, B, and C malls. What does that mean?
Well, an A mall typically has sales per square foot of $465 and up. And the best malls in the country can have sales per square foot of something like $1,000 a square foot. Once you drop into B, C, and D territory, those sales figures fall to $300, $200, $100 per square foot. And if you're below $300, it's really hard to make a go of it.
What does it take to be a Class A mall these days? Simon Property owns a lot of very luxurious malls. Is that where the high numbers are?
Well, they own the most A malls of anybody out there, and it's various factors. You have to be in the right areas where the population is thriving, growing, obviously, you know, areas where there's good economic growth. You have to have the right mix of retailers, you know, luxury retailers, the Michael Kors of the world, you know, Apple, the stores that make people want to go out and shop. And you've got to have, you know, that formula of the enclosed shopping mall is feeling very outdated today, where you stick a few department stores on the end and you fill it in with a bunch of specialty retailers. So mall owners are looking for ways to kind of freshen up the idea of what a mall should be. They're adding, you know, theaters where they have concerts. They're, you know, all kinds of high-end restaurants. restaurants. They're trying to create, you know, make it more like a community, but in an updated way.
Now, some are thriving. Some are just coming down. What do those numbers look like? I mean, we see plenty of demolition going on out there.
Well, according to CoStar, which tracks this sort of thing, as of the fourth quarter, there were 76 malls with vacancy rates of 20% to 40%, meaning that they're at high risk for closure. There are another 39 malls that had vacancy rates in excess of 40%. These are zombie centers that really have very little chance of recovering. But you also have to put that in context that they're about they're close to 1,200 malls in this country, and 90% of them have vacancy rates of 20% or less. So, you know, at the bottom, there is certainly a good number of malls. You know, Green Street Advisors, which is another real estate tracking firm, they think there could be like 60 malls that close over the next 5 years. There are going to be more of these closures, but you also have a lot of malls that are doing just fine.
It's a very interesting story you've written very recently, Suzanne, about Apple and these Apple stores. When they come into a mall, the effect of that on the mall, both on traffic and on rent for other tenants.
That's right. Apple single-handedly can lift a mall's sales by 10%. And that is, you know, that's a huge dynamic, because it was typically the department stores, the Macy's, the Nordstrom's, the Sears, the JCPenney's, that were responsible for bringing traffic to the mall. But as we've seen, you know, Sears and Penny are having a hard time. They're closing stores. When an anchor like that closes a store at a mall, it drags down the entire performance of the mall. So I spent some time at Southlake Mall outside of Atlanta last year, which had just lost the JCPenney store.
Yeah.
And the retailers I spoke to, they said their sales had fallen off by 30% after that Penny store closed. So Apple is sort of replacing those typical anchors as a driver of traffic to the mall.
Talk to us about the volume of business that a single Apple store can do and what that means for the mall and other tenants.
Well, I mean, you know, you have the highest grossing Apple stores, and these aren't necessarily malls. They're in, you know, in Rockefeller Center in Manhattan and other places, that they can do something like $100 million in sales a year. But A single store, yeah.
Good heavens.
But your typical mall-based Apple store, which is a lot smaller, you know, maybe it's doing like $30 million in sales a year, which is, you know, when you break it down for the size of that store, it works out to something like 6,000 sales in sales per square foot, which compared to a typical department store does something like $400 in sales per square foot. So you can see the difference.
And now with Apple bringing out the iWatch, you're introducing this new fashion element that people are anticipating even in Apple, what we thought of as computer or phone stores.
Right, and we're told that they're going to be sort of adding a new element to their stores where you can, it's by appointment shopping for people who want to try on these watches. You know, some of the very high-end Apple watches are going to cost like $10,000. So they're going to try to make it more of a luxury shopping experience for those customers.
I was very interested, Suzanne, in learning from your piece about how mall rental or presence worked. The old anchor stores, the big JCPenney and those, they tended what? To own the property that they were in. It was the smaller stores within the mall that actually paid rent, or I guess more accurately, a portion of their sales to the mall owner.
That's correct. That's correct. And, you know, the trade-off was the department store was going to drive all this traffic to the other stores at the mall. So, you know, they either own their own space, or if they rented, they really paid very little rent. Maybe they paid some common charges. But, you know, they were the ones who were going to bring the customers to the mall. So that was the trade-off. But the smaller retailers in between, they paid the bulk of the rent. They can pay, you know, as much as 15% of their sales per square foot in rent.
But because Apple has so much traffic, it can bargain pretty hard. I'm reading you reporting that sometimes Apple pays no more than 2% of its sales to be in the mall.
That's correct. That's correct. I mean, you know, every mall owner wants an Apple store, so Apple really is in the driver's seat there. But, you know, it's a double-edged sword, because unlike the department stores, which you know, you'd go to a department store and then you'd probably go into the mall and go to a couple of other stores. People who go to Apple don't necessarily visit the other retailers in the mall. They may go to Apple, they may go to one other store and a restaurant and then leave. So it's not clear that the other tenants are getting the spillover traffic.
And because Apple can negotiate such a low revenue share with the owner, the others may have to pay more.
Well, it drives up, it puts pressure on rents, because if Apple's increasing sales at the mall, part of how rents are derived stem from how well the mall's doing. So if the mall's doing better, the mall owner can go to the other tenants and say, look, the sales at this mall are really high. You're going to have to pay more rent if you want to be here.
Overall, how much of the decline of the mid-mall or lower-tier mall is related directly to the decline of the middle class? I mean, we see Simon Property going for expansion. They're very heavy in the luxury malls, and they've got some big rollers betting behind them. Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, is advising them on this. They're buying up another sort of high-roller mall outfit that's advised by Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. Is this a bet on the continued thriving of the, the 1%?
Well, yeah, it's no secret. The 1% have money and they're spending it, and the rest of us are struggling, even though, it's been how many years since the recession? People are still spending their money very carefully. Even with lower gas prices, there hasn't been a huge spillover into higher spending at retail stores. So that's definitely a factor. But another part of the equation is a lot of these malls, they were built in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and the populations have since shifted. And a mall that used to be in a really thriving area, that area may not be doing so well now. So that's part of it, too.
What about online shopping? How big a piece of the hit to malls comes from that quarter?
Well, that's absolutely having an effect. You can call it the end of the impulse purchase. So in the past, people would go to the mall, they'd wander around. Maybe they didn't really know what they were looking for. They went into a bunch of different stores. And more often than not, they ended up buying stuff that they didn't plan to buy. Now people spend a lot of time researching online. Before they set foot in a mall, they know exactly what they want. And they just go to one or two stores and they buy what's on their list. They very rarely go off their list. So that's definitely having an effect.
And when they really start to fail, what decides whether they're just torn down, blown up, Dr. Dynamite comes in, as one of our guests today says, or they get repurposed? Sometimes in dramatic ways, we hear about churches buying malls or chunks of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it depends on the area and sort of what the area can handle. A lot of times, these malls, they can't be repurposed as other retail space because the demographics just aren't there. So if you can bring in, a medical center, commercial tenants, sometimes conference centers, health clubs, there are a lot of different things you can do with these properties, but they're not necessarily good for retail anymore.
It can make a big difference to a local community, and there's a lot of change going on here. The mall is in big flux. Suzanne Kapner covers it for the Wall Street Journal. Suzanne, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the state of malls in America. Many are dying. Some are going strong. Some are dragging towns down. Some are finding a new life. It's a story about retailing and the new shape of our economy, where we live, how we shop. Things going in all kinds of directions. Here's from the Mill Creek Town Center. It's an open-air mall near Seattle, opened in 2004. Talks about itself not in old-fashioned terms as a mall, but as a lifestyle center. Over 70 stores connected to each other and to the town by a nature trail.
Mill Creek Town Center is a new lifestyle center and outdoor mall located in the scenic city of Mill Creek, Washington, just north of Seattle. The mall has a park-like setting and is nestled among nature trails and creeks in the surrounding community.
Sometimes you've got to bring in, fancy talent to keep things rolling. 2012, South Korean rapper Psy performed his giant hit Gangnam Style at a free concert at a mall, University Mall, Tampa, Florida. Here he is the day after talking about his mall show.
I had a really great time yesterday in a University Mall. And check this out.
Woohoo! The whole mall going Gangnam Style, whatever it takes. Paco Underhill joins us now from New York. He's CEO and founder of EnviroCell, a behavioral research and consulting firm, author of Call of the Mall and Why We Buy. Paco, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom, are you starting to thaw out in Boston?
barely, but all the malls are not covered these days anymore. I wonder, that there's this whole trend of people tearing off
the covered walkways and the walls and turning everything into outdoor malls, even in the north. What's driving that, Paco?
I think it's trying to give you a little sensual feel under your feet. So there are changes in pavement. It's also trying to duplicate the nostalgia that many of us have of shopping downtown.
So we got all kinds of response from people here. Here's a kind of typical thing, Paco, from Facebook. Jonathan says, the Eastland Mall in Charlotte, North Carolina was shuttered for years. The developer wanted to turn the site into a film production studio, sought public incentives. City balked at the incentives. The developer pulled out. Now the site is a large gravel pit surrounded by asphalt. What determines what turns into a gravel pit and what turns into a thriving mall these days?
Oh, boy, that's a tough question, Tom. Certainly one of the critical factors is location. And I think just as your previous guest stated, most of the malls here in the U.S. were built in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And the communities that they served have transformed. And in some cases, they've gone for the better. In many cases, they've gone for the worse. Part of what we have to recognize as we look for malls to reposition is where geographically do they sit? And based on that geographic position, what could we do with them? Certainly, one of the things that we look at in other parts of the world is people don't build or reposition malls. They build or reposition alls, meaning that they are commercial spaces, they are residential spaces, and they're retail spaces where a certain percentage of your customer base, if they wanted to go shopping, could do it in their bedroom slippers.
Is the U.S. on the leading edge of that or trailing?
No.
Or
we left the leading edge of mall development 20 or 30 years ago. We can go to other parts of the world and there's so much more interesting stuff going on and much more focused and connected to a community and a much more sense of a cooperation between public and private interests.
Is that harder in the U.S. because malls were synonymous with the American phenom of sprawl and the suburbs? If a suburb starts to go south, if its middle class isn't healthy enough to support or there are too many malls there, maybe it's not part of an urban fabric that it might be more likely to be part of in Europe?
I think it's not just Europe where the leading edge is. It is in developing markets where malls offer a very unique proposition. First of all, they're safe, something that you may not find in India, Brazil, or Mexico. The second is that they're clean, and certainly with an emerging market population where lots of money is controlled by women whose radar for hygiene is much more highly calibrated, that is important. And the third one is that they're climate controlled. And if you're in Dubai or you're in Singapore, that matters.
But, I mean, those very things, I think those used to be attractive in the U.S. as well, safe, clean, and climate controlled. Now climate control has sort of lost favor in the U.S., it seems to me. Clean, I don't know. Some of these old malls can be pretty grungy, Paco.
That's right. I think you're absolutely right. And the easiest thing to change is the physical design. The hardest thing to change is the operating culture. But we look at other malls across the world, and they are built with the idea that there are schools and churches. There are doctor's offices. There are floors that are focused on female health issues. There are yoga studios next to dermatology offices. They're looking at traffic drivers over and beyond the simple department store or a technology store.
So if you look at this 1,200 malls across the United States, what's your sense of the directions that they're – what portion are going to go where? I mean, there's the – you can go high-end, and quite a few have, and they've done very well recently. Some of these companies that invest in malls are these REITs. They're giving back like 30, 35% returns recently. That's pretty strong. Others don't go so high end, but they really change their format. And others meet what you've called Dr. Dynamite. What portions do you expect to see there? Like a third, something else?
Almost all across the world of retail here in North America, many of the chains would be eminently healthier if they shed somewhere between 15 and 20% of their underperforming properties. One of the reasons why a REIT can actually do a better job of redeveloping a mall is because they can take the time. They aren't answerable to quarterly calls on Wall Street. They can take the time to cherry pick the property and actually do what's right. We recognize that so many malls across the U.S. 30 years ago were put up really quickly. They're put up on the cheap. Mm-hmm. They were butt ugly the day they opened, and they haven't gotten any prettier. We can go to a Vasco da Gama mall, which for in Lisbon, which was one of the meccas of mall development through the late 1990s, which is a breathtakingly beautiful place where at 10 o'clock at night, they have to shove people out the door so they can close the mall and clean it.
And what about the big Simon Property Group that's in the news these days? They're expanding. Their big, big focus is on luxury. How does that work for them? How does it work for the country?
I think probably one of the most powerful people in America to redefine how we live in both a commercial sense and an ecological sense is probably David Simon, who sits on the helm of Simon Property. He owns a tremendous amount of asphalt, and that asphalt, I think, needs to be reconceived.
I mean, people have, you know, Simon's got a lot of money. They're looking to put billions into more. They could put that money into anything, but he's making a bet on malls. Is it a good business bet? Is it a good civic bet, the way he's heading Simon Property?
I certainly think that if you look at a lot of B and C malls and you envision where they sit next to highways, many of them were built in the 60s at the moment at which our cities were expanding. Part of what we recognize is that shopping trends follow housing trends. We have two important generations of Americans that are coping with issues of how they're going to live. We have baby boomers who are going, how am I going to live the last third of my life? Do I really want to move to the Sun Belt? Or do I want to stay in my own community in places where I can still connect to my friends and my family, but I don't have to worry about the snow on my driveway?
Mm-hmm. So move into an apartment or a condo that's next to a mall.
That's correct. So if you look, for example, at the Natick Mall in your own native Boston, Tom, there are high-rises right there where somebody, if they want to, could park their car, go to the local PJ Chang's, and not have to worry about whether they drink that third martini or not, because they can walk home.
Just toddle home through the mall. Paco Underhill, stand by in New York. We have listeners from all over the country with contributions here. Caleb in Oklahoma City. Caleb, what do you see?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just going to tell you a quick story about a mall in my area.
Yes, please.
Can you hear me? Okay, great. It's called Crossroads Mall. It's next to I-240, and 5 years ago it shut down. My girlfriend, now wife, was working there at a little popcorn stand.
Yeah.
And it became depopulated. Everybody left. And so it was completely shut down for a while, and it was just laying kind of abandoned for a year. But a couple years ago, a large tarp went up with the words Palace Mayor on it. And it's become a Spanish-speaking mall, and like on Saturdays they have mariachi where my wife used to work. They now serve, you know, fruited drinks out of hollowed-out melons, and you can buy Mexican candy, and it's all in the center. As you go towards the edges, you'll walk down a large abandoned hallway, and at the end there'll be like a bouncy house or a moon bounce or something, you know, that you pay $5 for. But it feels really low key, But the entire thing is Spanish-speaking. It's actually a really cool place and, from my understanding, a pretty good center of that community. So,
Caleb, that's a fascinating piece of evolution right there in a mall, the Palace Mayor, and suddenly it goes from, what, on the edge to Spanish-speaking, and it's hanging in. I appreciate your call. We're talking about malls in America and where they're headed. They take communities with them very often or reflect what's going on. Let's go to Jesse in Austin, Texas. Jesse, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your story?
I have a similar story of a mall transformation here in Austin, Texas. The Highland Mall, a lower-tier mall, started to lose all its anchors. It also eventually closed down completely, and the city decided to use that space and transform it to for the local community college. So Austin Community College now runs almost the entire mall for classes and stuff like that.
This has become kind of a famous story, a good-sized mall. It was listed on America's Most Endangered Malls. And now do they have classes and administration and lots of the community college activity within the old mall complex, Jesse?
Yeah, that's correct.
People going in all kinds of directions. That looks like a success story. Does it look like a success story to you, Paco?
You know, Tom, if we go to San Francisco Center, right on Market Street, on level 6 in the shopping mall is a graduate program in executive education. Means that there's a turnover of students. They're reasonably affluent. During the workday, they come down to shop. They come down for lunch. Part of it is just simple, creative ways of how do I drive traffic. So, Le Grand Plaza is another shopping mall that sits outside of Fort Worth, Texas, and it is again themed with towards a Hispanic audience. There are some smaller shopping malls that are Asian focused and have gathered a certain density. Part of what this gets to is that why should all shopping malls all seem the same?
And they did for a long time.
Are there ways of being able to do something? Part of what we're calling this is placemaking, which is the simple concept that I do something with the space that provides the incentive for somebody to drive past three other properties and get to mine. And it isn't just about shopping. It could be about social activities, could be about something to look at, could be the fine art that's in it, or it could be the trade fair that happens in the asphalt parking lot that changes every 6 weeks.
It's fascinating. For a long time, malls seemed like the great steamroller of homogenization in this country. Maybe they're going the opposite way to survive. Now, Jeff in Boston, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I feel like, there's a lot of things that I would cross state lines for if I needed to, like IKEA, It's like I don't love going there, but when I need to go there, I go there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, especially when it comes to home design stuff, if you had like sort of a themed mall, sort of like the auto miles, where every building is a car dealership,
people
go there for that. What if it was like, one place was flooring and one place was, paint and stuff like that, and they sort of, you go there for inspiration and ideas, and it's sort of a destination. There's like there's stuff for kids. There's all kinds of stuff, or for that matter, turn it into like a multi-faith place of worship, where like every store is a different church or synagogue, and then they can share the snow removal in the wintertime, and they can have food drives and all the kind of stuff that people do. all together. I feel like as long as it's like a theme where everybody wants to go for the same thing.
I love it. Jeff, our time is short before the break, but let us pick it up sort of. Can you see it, Paco? Maybe the super home decor mall where it's all that, or the multicultural religious mall where it's Christian, Jewish, Baha'i, Buddhist, Muslim, right on down the storefronts.
Well, two things there. First of all, we have Kabbalahs here, which in some states is the single most popular tourist destination.
The big sporting goods, state. Super sporting goods and gun
stores. Sporting goods. And people will drive and camp in the parking lot. It's sort of funny because it's a store that gives often middle-aged men with the presence of
Disneyland,
fishing equipment and hunting equipment per mission to shop for, you know, clothes and underwear.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the state of malls in America. Many are dying, some are going strong, some are dragging towns down, some are finding a new life. Paco Underhill is with us, CEO of EnviroCell, a behavioral research and consulting firm out of New York, author of Call of the Mall and Why We Buy. With us right now from Denver, Colorado, is Mark Falcone, principal at the real estate development firm Continuum Partners. With the help of the city government out there, he bought on the dead mall Via Italia in Lakewood, Colorado, and built from scratch a new mall called Belmar. Mark Falcone, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So you bought an old one, you made it into a new one, and what's the difference? What's the transformation?
Well, I'm not sure that I'd characterize Belmar as a mall. I think what Villa Italia, when it was first built in 1965, was a pretty conventional shopping mall. It was, you know, certainly state-of-the-art at the time it was built, and for 20 or 30 years was an enormously successful retail property. But by the early 90s, for a lot of the reasons that have been referenced earlier, it started to experience a lot of the kind of decline that, you know, what we characterize as B and C malls, you know, start to demonstrate. And it was pretty apparent that a mall was going to be was no longer really relevant there in its current configuration. And the city of Lakewood, which is where the mall was located, you know, didn't really want you know, this thing to go through a 10 or 20 year sort of convulsive erosion of value, turning it into, you know, kind of a you know, cheap, you know, sort of real estate space that was serving all kinds of uses. It really wanted to turn it into something that really could effectively serve as the downtown for their city.
And we should say, this is a city that grew up around the mall. The mall came first in this case, Mark.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, the mall was built in 1965, and the city was only incorporated in 1969. But the day it was incorporated, it was, I think, the fourth largest city in the state.
So, but what you've got going there now, you don't even call a mall. You say Belmar is a shopping and dining district. So describe the physical transformation.
Well, you know, the mall was a 104-acre piece of property at a very high-value intersection with a lot of traffic. So it was a commercially relevant, you know, piece of property. But the problem was that the mall was completely dependent upon a very narrow, you know, purpose of trip, right? It had you know, these malls, your principal purpose for going there is to shop. And if the shopping, if the collection of stores and shops that are draw you there starts to, you know, become less relevant, then your need to go to that place becomes less compelling. And what the city really wanted and what we wanted to help them provide was a much more diverse set of activities that would ensure that this, you know, that this area, which is the center of their recently formed city, would be relevant for a very long period of time. That it would not be, you know, the thing that they identified with as their city center would not simply ebb and flow with the, you know, with the whims of broader economic trends. But there was a much more diverse set of activities going on there.
I mean, it's so interesting because malls came in and killed a lot of downtown retail districts. But now you're converting this 100 plus acres into a downtown. How have you done that?
Kind of the irony is amazing, right? Because, I mean, you know, this mall was one of the reasons that downtown Denver lost its retail vitality.
Yeah.
And the city of Lakewood, which was a suburb, actually used Urban Renewal Authority, which was originally developed and established to help rescue these core city downtowns, to actually take down this mall and to set the platform for us to be able to come in and reestablish this land in a much more relevant way. So I should probably really clarify that it's you know, while there is a significant amount of shopping and restaurant and entertainment activity here, there are also, you know, several hundred thousand square feet of office space. There's a very large advertising agency that offices here. There is a hotel under construction. There is, you know, there are 1,400 residential units. There's a senior housing. And the residential is from all varieties, everything from senior housing to, you know, for-sale townhomes to rental apartments to stacked flat condominiums. I mean, it's a very, very broad, diverse set of activities that have replaced this, you know, this very narrow set of activities that was the Villa Italia Mall.
And you've taken it off the mall format and put it back on the, more like a traditional urban grid, right? 22 city blocks, as I read here.
It's exactly what we did. I mean, you know, look, we... Well, one of the challenges with these malls is that they are these big BMFs that, you know, people think of as, because they're privately owned and controlled, that in some ways they would be more adaptable. But in fact, there are all these layers of encumbrances that get layered on, these private agreements that get layered onto these malls when they're built. So this department store can control how many parking spaces you can add or take away at the other end of the mall, and all these things. So what happens is, when the malls want to adapt and evolve, they have to overcome all these private agreements that are very, very challenging to overcome. In some ways, you're almost better off when the mall goes all the way to zero, and it's almost abandoned, and all of those economic interests are simply people just kind of walk away from them. And then you can kind of start with a clean sheet of paper, which is what we had the opportunity to do. And so we just reconnected the grid that came up to the mall, which the mall had interrupted, with its large kind of, you know, Battlestar Galactica kind of footprint.
Yep.
And we were able to reconnect all those things, which made it much more relevant to the neighborhoods around it.
Mark Falcone, stand by in Denver, if you would, and Paco Underhill in New York. Daniel's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Daniel, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. So here in Burlington, Vermont, to piggyback off of the previous caller, there is exactly that going on downtown. There is a mall that is connected to Church Street. And the mall is going through $250 million renovation, in which they are going to do something what's been called unmall the mall. So take it away from being a single-held, privately owned facility and turn it into a community plaza where there are going to be private condominiums, apartments, senior citizen, dining. Here in Vermont, we've seen a huge change from the younger generation going to the food court to now going to Chipotle, and to use the term relevancy, value as being relevant. TJ Maxx and Marshall's now, right across from Chipotle, are just packed every single day. So we're seeing kind of a two-pronged forces on the malls getting hit. One is by mobile, and interesting here, Apple has iBeacons coming out for retailers to use mobile, but that's being hit by Amazon.
You mean your product is here? Come on in. We've got a deal for you. That sort of thing.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It appears as though mobile is both a strong force, an opportunity, if you will, and also a threat. Right now, it's more of a threat, as someone can go into a mall, shop around, and then find the product on Amazon for cheaper. But Apple has opened the door here for retailers to use the mobile as a strong suit, as an opportunity, with this notion of iBeacons. So you're right, Tom. You walk in, you're greeted by the app. It directs you to a sale from your previous purchase. So just here in Vermont, we're seeing kind of a two-pronged approach. Mobile is being the future, but also consumer preferences have changed, where they value Chipotle and they value value. And so we see an immense growth in TJ Maxx and Marshall's.
Daniel, thanks for your call. I want to take it to my guest, Paco Underhill. What are you thinking as you hear about this unmalling of the mall, in this case in Burlington, Vermont, but I'm sure this is going on elsewhere or being considered elsewhere. What's your advice on how to make that successful?
Well, I think we go back to the basic concept that we started with, which is that shopping trends follow housing trends, and that there are a whole bunch of us, whether it's across North America or across the world, that would like to be closer to where we shop and like to be closer to where we work. The driving factor in modern consumption is convenience. And it's that convenience that has driven us online, but it's also that convenience that has driven us to find different solutions using our mobile phones as a way of getting us to the right place. Let me give you an example. Okay. I have a friend named Asye who owns a boutique in downtown Madison, Connecticut, a small town on the Connecticut shore. She has an evening wear business where she has a phone app where if you come buy a dress from her, you register the dress, you register the event that you're wearing the dress to, and she guarantees no one else will wear the same dress to the same function.
Okay.
Okay? She registers, I don't know, somewhere between, 200, 300 events a year, which range from, you know, high school proms to charity balls. And her trade area is probably close to 150 miles, meaning somebody drives past Macy's and Saks and Neiman Marcus to go buy their dress from her.
This is such
it's in a
deep,
downtown
specific
location next to a movie theater. And you know what? It's just clever. And that's part of what mobile technology gives you is the ability to often compete with the big boys by better understanding your market.
I mean, that seems like such deep personal engagement, almost the opposite of what we had long expected from the mall. Mark Falcone, for Burlington or other towns looking to unmall the mall, your advice?
Well, I think Burlington's situation is a little bit unique because that's embedded right in the downtown as he was describing it. But I think that every opportunity is going to be different. In fact, that's the opportunity, is to sit there and allow your place to become authentic and to become unique and to become differentiated. Malls cease to be differentiated, and that's part of what's hurting them. They don't offer the same depth and richness of experience that people are seeking right now, especially, the young generation, the millennial generation in the U.S. You think about Starbucks and what a profoundly new experience that was for Americans when they first came out. And now, you sort of look at that great little, artisanal coffee shop right across from Starbucks, and you look at Starbucks, and Starbucks is going to have a hard time competing with these little one-off artisanal guys that are doing amazing, just doing amazing drinks that they can't do at Starbucks because of their scale and because of their size. So I think there are opportunities when communities are wrestling with, this place that they identified, as a way to move forward. One challenge is that the infrastructure sometimes surrounding malls are difficult. They're not very adaptable. And the malls that were built later tended to be built, the malls that were built in the 80s and 90s tended to be built in the farthest edges of our metropolitan areas. And those infrastructures tend to be much more single purpose in their nature. Office parks are separated from residential subdivisions, which are separated from commercial strips. And those streets and those infrastructures don't sort of connect very well. And that grid that we were able to reconnect this 100 acres to in Lakewood, Colorado, doesn't often exist. And that worries us as developers when we look at opportunities like this. Now, we are in western suburbs of Chicago right now. We are taking a large mall that's called Yorktown Center, and we're taking about a 10-acre piece of that mall, and we're adding 1,500 residential units to it. And that will help the mall. That'll be a first step in creating a diversity of activities around that mall, which over time, I'm guessing, will lead to it'll catalyze a set of activities that over the next 20 years could enrich that place in a much more meaningful way.
Christy in Oklahoma City. Christy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I've lived in Oklahoma City for about 20 years, so I've been able to see it's absolutely true. When the anchor stores go out, that almost kills the mall. But similarly, whenever large major stores come in, that just attracts consumers like moths to a flame. I actually used to work for Apple, but I'll tell you that sometimes working for these big stores isn't always a good thing. The store that I worked in was always extremely popular. And if I would ever leave the store for a break, it's like the rest of the mall just came to almost like a crawl. But it was so packed and so crowded and just overstimulous with all the lights and noise and people and products and lines and everything that it was almost overwhelming at times for a lot of the employees. And it was the only job I've ever had where I've had a legitimate panic attack. it was just intense because there were so many people, and it was just crazy.
Christy, it sounds like the manager's dream may be the employee's nightmare there. If you're having a panic attack, that sounds like a lot of customers in the store. I'm also reading here, Paco, just in this week, Wall Street Journal reporting that the same company, Canadian company, that owns the Mall of America in Minnesota is looking at building the American Dream Miami, the biggest mall in the country. It would be bigger than the Mall of America, $4 billion investment anticipated here. Why, if malls are going the other way all over the place, why build the biggest super-duper mall ever in Miami now, Paco?
I think that's an excellent, excellent question. I am not a huge fan of triple five. The Mall of America isn't aging well, and the Edmonton Mall that their company is anchored in sort of sits as the only real shopping between, you know, Toronto and Vancouver. So it draws a different kind of audience. I also note that they're the company that earned the contract to redo Xanadu at the Meadowlands, which is now 2 years behind schedule. So do I think they could do something? Yes, but they better do it really well, and they better have everything built in so that someone goes to live there, work there, and shop there.
The automatic age of the mall, well behind us now. All kinds of things going on in that future. American life and retail changing right along with it. Paco Underhill at EnviroCell in New York. Thank you so much for joining us today, Paco.
Tom, it's my pleasure. Please ask me back.
And Mark Falcone in Denver, Colorado at Continuum Partners. Good luck with your Bel Air project there, Mark.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.